Okay, any housekeeping or preliminary issues or questions? Yes, Mr. Sharma. It's sort of all of the above. That is, it's essentially a free shot on goal. I go there, I wait for students to ask me questions. As long as people ask me questions, I do the best I can to answer them. When nobody can think of anything more to ask, we go home. So, I think if you talk to people who went to at least, you know, one Q&A session last year, they will have varying reports on how helpful it was. And I guess I would say if there are things that it would be really nice to be able to go and just ask a question without worrying that I was chewing up somebody else's valuable time. I'd also like to be there when other people ask questions that maybe I hadn't thought of, but once they asked them, I realized, gee, I wanted to know the answer to that too. And some people find that very helpful, and some people consider it a waste of time. So that's why it's optional for you to be there. I try not to do anything. It's not like there's something that's going to happen there. I also record them, put them on the MP3 site there. So if you want the benefit of that, it's there as well. Other preliminary questions? Okay, we left off on Wednesday talking about Learned Hands formula, and just to sort of summarize the kind of larger philosophical jurisprudential issue, we didn't reach any final conclusion about whether or not the Learned Hand formula was something very useful, in fact, close to the heart of what the tort system is really about, or whether the Learned Hand formula is a deceptive and potentially sort of perverse reduction of a complex moral universe to some utilitarian concept of efficiency. I think you could find people advocating both of those positions. For your purposes, I think what you want to recognize, again, I'm sort of trying to put you in the mood of being a practicing trial lawyer who has clients with tort cases, to see that in some kinds of cases, particularly cases that involve complex decision-making, ones where a sort of intuitive feel for things won't get you very far, that being able to express these complex, you know, design considerations in a formula can be quite helpful. It may be very helpful to the plaintiff to show that for a very modest amount of expenditure, the defendant could have, in effect, purchased a very valuable quantum of safety. By contrast, the defendant may find it helpful to express, the difficulty of trying to accomplish safety where you have a variety of different competing needs and where tweaking this little thing over here means that that area over there of equal or perhaps greater value will be adversely affected. And again, quantifying these sorts of considerations may prove persuasive for your client. On the other hand, obviously, there are cases where an attempt to reduce something to a learned hand formula would be almost comical. And then again, I said, if you try to take the WASP case and apply learned hands formula to that, I don't think it would get you very far. Again, I think you can see that some cases lend themselves more to a kind of technocratic equation-oriented approach, and some lend themselves more to a kind of intuitive, gee, what would I think a person ought to do in that circumstance? And as you find it either helpful or not helpful, you may point that out to your client or begin sort of looking around at the evidence to see if there's something that would fit or not fit. Now, today's case, Levi versus Slemko, or the opening case for today, I hope to get beyond it here, but Levi versus Slemko is obviously the application of this formula in a way that lets you see it in action. So, Mr. Towler, is that the way you say it? Tell me about Levi. Okay, so the nature of his he gets very badly hurt, and who is he suing here? Who's Slemko? No, actually, I think Slemko. Yeah, the power company. Okay, so and what's his basic ground for seeking compensation? What's his argument? Okay, and again, just to sort of do our really basic review here, his burden, if he wants to recover damages, is to establish what? Okay, that they failed to use reasonable care, that they were negligent, and that sort of backs us up to the question of, well, can we say that a reasonable person, obviously they didn't separate these lines or move them in a way that would reduce the likelihood of somebody contacting them. And so you're getting to the next logical question, which is, well, would a reasonable person have moved the lines to reduce the likelihood that a guy like the plaintiff would hit them in the course of his work? And okay, so that's the basic argument. They were negligent in not relocating the lines. Their argument is, no, we weren't negligent, or that's their position. What happens when the case gets tried? Who did? You're right, but I just want to make sure, are we talking about the judge directing a verdict or granting summary judgment? How is it that the defendant winds up winning? And again, the reason we care about this sort of thing is to figure out, well, what is the burden of the losing party in the appeal? Is the losing party saying, I never got my day in court, the trial judge ruled against me as a matter of law, I'm saying this is a question about which reasonable minds could differ? Is it a case where the jury decided against the appealing party and therefore you have to show that as a matter of law the jury should have found in their favor? Again, the different procedural positions create a different climate or burden of proof. What do your notes say there about the who won in the, or otherwise anybody? Okay, so there was a verdict, and if the plaintiff's the one who wants a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, we therefore can conclude that it was the defendant who got the jury to agree with the defendant. The jury found they weren't negligent. So the plaintiff's now appealing that, saying a terrible mistake has been made here. And so the plaintiff wants the appellate court to find the defendant negligent. How does the plaintiff propose to do that? On what basis should the appellate court say notwithstanding the jury's verdict for the defendant really was negligent here. Pardon? How do we know that? Yeah. Sort of like the turntable case, maybe here. We have the sort of foreseeability of this kind of harm. But what makes the appellate court think, or what is the plaintiff arguing should make the appellate court think, that they were negligent in failing to move these lines? Okay. In other words, they explicitly employed this learned hand formula, looking at, okay, what's it going to cost to move these lines? How likely is it that we're going to get over the lifetime of this facility, we're going to get an accident like this? Is it an accident waiting to happen, in effect? And finally, what's the magnitude of the harm? Is it really so bad when one of these rigs accidentally contacts a high-voltage electrical line? Yeah, that's a very, very bad day in the oil business, as they say. And therefore, the plaintiff says this is negligent as a matter of law. What does the appellate court say to that argument? Again, we're overriding the jury's verdict at this point, or we're asking the court to do that. Yeah, they say they were negligent. And therefore, the only question we have left, basically, is, well, how bad were his damages? Now, not everybody agrees on this point. There are some other opinions in the case here. There's a concurring opinion, but there's also a dissenting opinion. What's the point of the concurring opinion? And therefore, it's again, just keeping track of where people are coming out in these cases, the concurring opinion agrees with the general or main result here, that is, the judgment shouldn't be allowed to stand, the judgment for the defendant, it should be reversed, there should be a judgment for the plaintiff, but there's a difference in either some aspect of where it goes from here or a disagreement about the reasoning used to get to that result. And where is the point of departure here? In the concurring opinion? Mr. Harris? What's that? Who else does the concurring judge think was negligent here? Mr. Starnes? Why was the plaintiff negligent? Yeah, if you've got one of these rigs with this big mast, that's one of the things, if you see these big boom trucks plastered all over them, or the little graphics of a guy, getting fried by contact with an electrical line. So again, kind of job one, it would seem, if you're driving one of these things around, is to keep your eye out for where you're lifting this boom to avoid precisely this kind of accident. So at the very minimum, the jury has to factor in, even if the power company was negligent in leaving this power line so close to the oil well that had to be serviced, the plaintiff was negligent in not looking where he was raising this thing up. Okay, and there's also a dissenting opinion here. What's the point of the dissenting opinion? That is, the dissenting opinion disagrees with the outcome. Mr. Breck? Okay. The thing that would make the defendant negligent, that is, that the reason you would be worried about things like this happening is that a guy driving a truck like this has got to service the oil well, and so you want to move the power lines away from the place where this servicing would be going on. But that risk wasn't what caused this accident. The guy parked his truck to service his own truck, to fix something in his own truck, and he could have done that anywhere. It just happened that he did it close to the oil well, but that wasn't why he was, the risk of harm that would make it negligent to leave the lines in place was not a cause. You'll see I flinch at the term the cause. It was not a cause of this accident. But he's writing in dissent. The rest of the court is satisfied that the thing that made the placement of these lines negligent, namely their proximity to where people would be using equipment like this, that was close enough for close enough to the injury that happened here so that it was appropriate to find these guys negligent and impose liability. Now, again, all of this is kind of a long way around the barn to illustrate the way in which if the evidence weighs in the plaintiff's favor to show that for a modest expenditure of money, the defendant could have prevented a harm to the plaintiff, well, that's going to help the plaintiff either persuade the jury that the defendant was negligent, or in this case, using sort of a crowbar here, of the appellate court to force the finding of negligence. By contrast, again, some of the judges and presumably the jury didn't see the connection. They thought it was that the plaintiff essentially didn't make his case. Okay, so with that, we are essentially done with our musing over the standard of reasonable care and the standard of negligence and what it means and how we sort of think about it. Again, we don't have, we're left in a certain state of ambivalence in the nature of this or the definition of what constitutes reasonable care or the lack of reasonable care. But such as it is, we now move forward to look at specific ways of meeting that test. How does the plaintiff go about showing that something was negligent? Or, to flip it around, how does the defendant, what sort of evidence can the defendant use to persuade the jury that reasonable care was used and that the that the defendant wasn't negligent. Before we go on, was there any, Mr. Breck, yeah? Right. Right. I'm not entirely sure. I can't remember. It's been a long time since I read this case and edited it in its original form. And I can't remember whether there were other procedural issues in the case, you know, evidentiary rulings or other kinds of things that were complained about, so there was sort of some unfinished business even at the appellate court level, or whether it was a kind of polite way of saying to the appeals court, instead of simply saying, it's going back to the trial court, that's a sort of polite way of saying, like the, you know, when the flashing lights appear behind you and you pull over and the state trooper says, may I please see your license and registration, you know, that's a polite way of saying, basically, if you don't do it, I'm going to, you know, handcuff you and throw you in the back of a squad car. So whether this is just a polite way of doing that or whether there was other unfinished business, I don't know. But you're right. It appears that the only thing left is for the trial court essentially to impanel a jury and figure out what the damages were. Ms. Ma. Well, we actually get into that issue. Just for terminology purposes, the way I use the terminology and the way you'll find it used most often is the term contributory negligence is used to refer to negligence by the plaintiff. So in Martin versus Herzog, the plaintiff's failure to have a light on his buggy is considered contributory negligence, or is alleged to be contributory negligence. The question of how you treat that, what legal effect a finding of contributory negligence has, that specific question is taken up in some depth in Chapter 5. It turns out to be a complex sort of policy issue, statutory issue, and so forth. Just so these cases make sense, by the time Levi versus Slemko is decided, Texas follows. This is a Texas case. No, it's a Louisiana case. Louisiana is a civil code. It's not a civil law jurisdiction. It's not a common law jurisdiction. And they've used comparative negligence for a long time. When we get to Martin versus Herzog, the buggy case, we're dealing in an era when contributory negligence was a bar to recovery, so that any finding of any contributory negligence didn't have the effect of reducing your recovery, but leaving you with whatever negligence you could establish on the defendant's part. A finding of contributory negligence on the part of the plaintiff barred the plaintiff's claim altogether. So that's why, as when we get to Martin versus Herzog, the question about whether we let the jury make the finding about contributory negligence or whether we grab them by the scruff of the neck and point our finger in their face and say, this is what you're going to find, that's why it's so significant which of those two approaches we take. Okay, so now, again, we're off to the consideration or off on the consideration of these different sort of techniques, and my sort of analogy or mental image of this is that you're a plumber and you go from job site to job site with a truck full of different kinds of equipment, and depending on the job that you come to, whether it's a leaky faucet or a washing machine that has to be replaced or something else, you have a variety of different tools that, depending on the job site, may turn out to be useful or not. And your assignment here is essentially to learn how these different tools work so that when the need arises, you can use that tool and effect the repair. One sort of temptation that you run into is an expression I will use more than once in this class, that when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So sort of from the perspective of you get better and better at using a particular tool, and suddenly every problem you see, you want to use that tool on it. And that's not really good plumbing practice, and to the extent, by analogy, you wind up doing that as a lawyer, it's not very good legal practice either. I heard about, I'm trying to remember where the doctor was, I think it was in Redding, California, who did heart transplants on people that were passing through Redding. So they'd show up, this is a big scandal, I guess, they'd show up they'd come into the hospital complaining of chest pains, and the doctor would persuade them that they desperately needed a, a heart transplant, and he would, not a transplant, that's a bypass, transplant bypass, one of those things, yeah. But bypass surgery is pretty risky and pretty invasive, and from the doctor's perspective, of course, it was very lucrative. But it turns out he was taking people that had no need of a bypass operation and providing them with this, and by the time he'd done this, nobody was... anyway. So that's the kind of thing you don't want to be in the business of, is essentially overusing something. But as we go through each of these different kinds of cases, again, you want to become familiar with them. So, gee, if res ipsa loquitur or industry custom or post-accident repairs or something else is really the ticket to a finding of negligence in a particular case, you want to be prepared to be able to apply it. Okay, the first on our list here gets a very brief mention on page 21, this idea of juror experience. And I don't mean to say that this is some sort of separate category, legal category, but just to remind you that not every case falls within one of these other categories, that oftentimes, like the WASP case, the kind of accident that takes place is one that falls within the juror's everyday life experience. It's failing to keep a dog under control, or letting a fence get so maladjusted that it eventually doesn't close or it falls down or something else. And to the extent that jurors have experience with the activity in question, they're going to have their own ideas about whether this is something a reasonable person would or would not have done. And again, before you go charging off to try to apply some more exotic theory, you should ask yourself the question, is this an item where it's likely the jurors would sort of eyeball this situation and say, oh yeah, that was a dumb thing to do, or no, I've done that before, that's not a bad idea. And again, don't dismiss that just because it's sort of humble and uncomplicated. But then we turn to this idea of industry custom and what happens when the defendant's behavior is, in fact, you can reference the defendant's activity or choice or conduct to some kind of established industry custom or standard. What is the jury supposed to do with evidence that it conforms or doesn't conform to what is commonly done within the industry? Ms. Johnson, can you tell us about the Bennett case? I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last thing you said there. Okay. So his complaint against the railroad is what? Right. A reasonable person would have taken this extra precaution of providing some security from this. And there's also in this, there's a sort of ethnic slur here, which you probably noticed, that the assumption is that these Italians out here were causing mischief. And, you know, one of the things that you want to do as you read cases like this is to recognize that in certain times and places, things are sort of done in a particular way or are acceptable that later we say, gee, that's a pretty insensitive or discriminatory or inappropriate way to express yourself. And, you know, that's certainly something that you would not see in an opinion today. But there again, there are probably things we're writing today that we will look back in 50 years and say, gee, how could we have done that? Not to suggest that everything is relative here, but rather to be a little bit forgiving about the limitations of an era in terms of its ability to treat all people with equal respect. So, again, it's a little reminder that we all have a little work to do in that area. Okay, so back to the question about what standard we're going to use here. What's the defendant's argument with respect to the safety or lack of safety of this switch? Okay, so the defendant says, here is the evidence with respect to what is commonly done by railroads. So what's the kind of state of the art with respect to what's the standard practice with respect to these temporary switches? What's the plaintiff's argument? Mm-hmm. Right. Well, they didn't offer any evidence to contradict the defendant's claim that this was what was commonly done, but the plaintiff's argument to the jury, which apparently was successful, and I forget whether we reviewed the actual history here, but the trial of this ends in a verdict for the plaintiff. Apparently, the jury was persuaded that the defendant was negligent. How could the jury have found the defendant was negligent if apparently the defendant was doing what everybody else does? If you were the plaintiff's advocate, and you were trying to persuade the jury that the defendant acted negligently, and the defendant puts on all these railroad people who say, hey, this is the way we all do it, what might be your argument to the jury to overcome that or rebut that? A lock, even. Why would a reasonable person have put a lock in? And again, sort of using either explicitly or implicitly a kind of learned hand analysis, gee, it's a cheap precaution. It provides a significant benefit. Accidents like this are foreseeable and preventable, and a reasonable person would have taken this precaution. The fact that all these people don't do it doesn't mean that it's right. So the jury apparently agrees with the plaintiff and says that the defendant was negligent and ought to pay. The defendant obviously doesn't like that outcome, appeals the judgment of the jury. And what does the appellate court say when the defendant railroad asks for a different outcome? Give me the bottom line here. How does the appellate court decide this case? Do they agree with the railroad that they're entitled to a judgment, or do they let the jury verdict stand? Okay, and who gets to say what's reasonably safe? according to the industry. So in effect, what you have is this conflict here. The industry says one thing, the jury says another thing. The appellate court says, as between those two authorities, who's going to decide how we run the railroad? Yeah, the railroad people. They know what they're doing, after all. Who's the jury to tell the railroad how to run the railroad? Now, there's a certain amount of sense to that, and again, there would be a modern, I think, as I've said before, one of the criticisms, maybe I've said it before, one of the criticisms of the jury system is that in complex cases of aircraft design or automobile design or other kinds of things, who decides these complex questions of whether something was properly designed? Well, we get, you know, a retired elementary school teacher and a waiter and a guy who repairs brakes and a lady who files papers at an insurance agency. You know, we get a bunch of people that really are relatively unqualified to decide these highly technical questions. And one logical sort of response to that is say, if you want a jury of your peers, if the question is whether you were running the railroad in a reasonably prudent manner, you ought to get people who actually know what they're doing, the people in the railroad. Those are the people that ought to decide. And in effect, through this common practice, they have decided. So that's not an illogical response that the court would say, in effect, the standard of reasonable care is met when somebody conforms to what is commonly done within the industry. Now, as these cases illustrate, Bennett's one case, T.J. Hooper is another case. I often give you these pairs of cases in which your job is to figure out, well, how do these cases relate? How do I reconcile them? Do I say that one is right and one is wrong? Do I distinguish them to say they're both right, but they apply to different kinds of circumstances? The first case applies to this kind of case, but the second case applies to this different kind of case. They're not right or wrong, they just apply to different circumstances. Do I say that they reflect, you know, different kinds of jurisprudential evaluations or what? So again, the next case we have is T.J. Hooper, again from our old friend Learned Hand. As it turns out, T.J. Hooper was written much earlier. The Carroll Towing case comes out in whatever it is, 47 or something, 48, I forget when Carroll Towing is. But T.J. Hooper's back in the early 30s. And as you can see, Learned Hand's been getting this a steady diet of maritime or admiralty cases and seems to know what he's doing with respect to how these vessels operate. Mr. Alkiri, can you tell us about T.J. Hooper? Okay, and there's an interesting little wrinkle here with respect to radios. There was actually a statute that required a certain kind of radio. What kind of radio was required for these tugboats to carry? Right. By law, you had to carry a broadcasting radio, but it was up to you to decide whether you wanted a different kind of radio, which would receive, you could listen to the Yankees games, and you could listen to, Glenn Miller, right, or whoever it was that was popular on the radio those days. And, by the way, you could also pick up weather bulletins. Now, apparently, the plaintiff's property was lost because the defendant was not so blissfully unaware of this coming storm. And the plaintiff says that a reasonable person would have had a radio to warn the tugboat operators of this bad weather. How does Learned Hand propose that we decide the question of whether or not that was something a reasonable person would have done? Okay, so that's another wrinkle here, that in fact the negligence, arguably, of the defendant was not, they didn't even have a radio. They had a radio, but they'd allowed the radio to fall into disrepair. So maybe a modified form of that would be, would a reasonable person having a radio have spent the money to get it fixed or replaced? So again, In getting a fix on what a reasonable tugboat operator would have done, Learned Hand looks to the industry custom. What does he find when he looks for evidence about the industry custom? But what about receivers? What is the custom of the industry with respect to receiving radios? Oh, go ahead. Well, I think there is a little bit of evidence on the receiving part of it. Let's hold off on the reasoning there, but just that first little bit of information. It turns out we have neither the Bennett kind of case. Remember, in Bennett we have basically this monolithic universal practice of the industry to which the defendant conformed. We don't have a monolithic practice in the other direction. It's not that everybody has a working radio and this guy's the lone slowpoke. It's mixed. Some have it, some don't. Now, I want to just do a little bit of sort of legal reasoning here. This is kind of poaching into the territory of research and writing here, but this is a good case to illustrate the difference between this idea of holding and dictum, or dicta, the plural. When you look at a previous case as precedent, you're looking to find the holding of the case. What is sort of the irreducible, non-negotiable part of this case that if the case stands for anything, this is it. And unless you buy this proposition, you've got to reverse that case or distinguish it or do something else. At the same time, in addition to the holding of the case, there is so-called dictum or dicta, word or words, in which the court, a kind of, while it's at it, will tell you what it thinks about different things. Now, what is the holding in the case of T.J. Hooper? If the case stands for the proposition that because we have to look at the facts of the case to see what were the facts presented to the court and what did the court decide. The facts presented to the court were that there was a mixed practice. Some people had radios, some people didn't. What was the holding of the court? What was the outcome of the case? Okay. And again, just sort of reducing it to this, to the question, what's the holding of the case? Where there's a mixed practice, the jury can find the plaintiff liable. It's okay to impose liability where a defendant doesn't live up to the better part of industry custom, where there's a variety, there really isn't a custom per se, there's just a variety of different practices. Now, there's beyond the holding of the case, though, there is dictum, where a learned hand tells you what he thinks, not about the facts of this case, but about cases that might arise in the future raising the same issue. So again, this is not a clear black and white kind of thing where it's easily, you know, put in bold print or something you can just sort of look up in the case. It often requires you to think very closely or carefully, and it's very debatable, so that lawyers interpreting a previous case will argue about what is the holding of the case, but what is mere dicta. This is a frequent sort of adjective, dismissive adjective, because if you were the defendant in a subsequent case and the plaintiff is waving T.J. Hooper at you saying, see, this is what Learned Hand said in T.J. Hooper, you could point to this language and say, that's mere dicta. He was just blathering on about what he happened to think, but he wasn't speaking authoritatively there because those weren't the facts of his case. Now, the mere dicta that you would point to, which is much stronger, goes to a different kind of case. What does Learned Hand say about the relationship between industry custom and a finding of reasonable care? Ms. Haynes? Yeah, he goes directly against what the court said in Bennett. In Bennett, the court says, we mere lay people ought to defer to the people who really know what they're doing, the people who run the railroad. If they say it's okay, it's okay. Learned Hand said, not in my court. In the end, I say what's reasonable care. Sure, he says. What is commonly done is persuasive authority. After all, people whose very lives depend upon the safety of their operations ought to be given some credit for weighing what would, you know, if radios would save lives, you'd think they'd go out and buy radios. And if they don't find that it's worth it for them to buy radios, we should be kind of reluctant to assume they don't know what they're doing. So, you know, in this passage here on the right-hand column on page 24, he says, about five lines down, second column, he says, indeed, in most cases, reasonable prudence is in fact common prudence, but strictly it is never its measure. This is the critical language. A whole calling may have unduly lagged in the adoption of new and available devices. It, meaning the industry, never may set its own tests, however persuasive be its usages. So again, he's saying the relationship here is that industry custom is persuasive. Good luck trying to persuade a jury that these bozos don't know what they're doing. But I reserve the right, he says, in effect. Courts must, in the end, say what is required. There are precautions so imperative that even their universal disregard will not excuse their omission. So he's saying, I reserve the right to decide that even though the entire industry does one thing, I'm going to say, sorry, not good enough. Who says so? I say so. No longer deference to the industry, assuming they know better than we do. We will take their input and then make up our own mind. Now, again, this is dictum or dicta. He's talking about a case he doesn't have in front of him. And in a future case, you might persuade a court, I don't know what he was smoking, but, you know, don't pay any attention to that. You could disregard this language and decide a different case without saying we hereby overrule T.J. Hooper. So again, just a little point about sort of learning how to read cases in legal reasoning, the distinction between holding and dicta. One is essential to the case. The other is a kind of, oh, while we're at it, here's what we think about other matters. We'll pick that point up. I'll tie this up together tomorrow, and then we'll move on to Martin versus Herzog.